I want you to know that this is The Vinyl Preacher, your weekly podcast where we talk about the Bible and make a playlist. I'm Mac Hato, pastor at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Los Angeles, California.
Cut it out.
What a reference.
I'm Zach Paris. I'm the pastor of Lutheran Campus Ministry, University of Colorado. We're together at St. Aidan's Episcopal Church. We support a community of students called Bread and Belonging.
No guests today, Zach. It's just us.
Just us. But we've got stories. Oh. We've got musical. I think today we're going to lean into the musical edge of this podcast because we have musical stuff to talk about.
We do. Where do you want to start?
I want to hear all about it, Matt, because in sixth grade, I mean, I loved Alanis Morissette and Jagged Little Pill. I did not have the album, Matt. I want to say this is the 25th anniversary, or recently it was the 25th anniversary of Jagged Little Pill.
But let's be honest. If you had a radio, you basically had the album.
Yeah.
Because it was
I heard it all the time.
Anytime
I went to my friend's house, I was just hoping they play the Ironic video because it was awesome. It blew my mind in sixth grade, right? That there are four different Alanis Morissettes in the car with the different colored sweaters. The issue was that I ran the CD scam with Columbia. And so I had Columbia signed artists, and Alanis's Jagged Little Pill, I believe, was on Atlantic, and that was a different, like, 17 CDs for a penny scam. Mm-hmm. And so it was not even an option for me. And of course, I'm not going to buy things at the time. And you could only buy CDs in my town at Walmart, and they were censored. And you don't want to be the lame kid with the censored version of Jagged Little Pill.
I mean, it would save you that moment that we all had where we had to, like, turn on the volume real quick or cough or incredible, incredible stuff. Mm.
But you saw her yesterday.
I mean, I just, you know, a couple weeks ago, I get a little email from the Hollywood Bowl saying that Alanis Morissette had a 25th anniversary tour, 26 years after Jagged Little Pill. And I was like, oh, if only we could find a babysitter. And we did. And we went. We got tickets. We went. Let me tell you about Zach. We live in Hollywood. We live in Los Angeles. But the first time that we drove through the actual Hollywood Boulevard, my wife, Chris, said, I have never wanted to come here. So, Hollywood, not our favorite place in the world. Although we do have some wonderful memories at things like the Yamashiro Farmer's Market, which is really cool. The Magic Castle we went to one time is legendary. And the Hollywood Bowl, which is where this concert was. Hollywood Bowl is an outdoor venue. It's not quite as legendary as Red Rocks, I'm sure, but it is like our outdoor, cool outdoor venue, you know? So it's like, this is good. It's good. We went to Hollywood. We drove up there like 5 o'clock, so it took us an hour to get all the way there in LA rush hour traffic. And when we got to Hollywood and Highland, we were going to park and there was all these people standing outside on the sidewalk. And I was like, huh, wonder if something's going on in Hollywood today. Maybe somebody's getting their star on the Walk of Fame. And I Googled it. Daniel Craig, James Bond himself.
Wow.
We saw Daniel Craig get his star on the Walk of Fame. random things that happen
just every day in Hollywood.
And
stuff,
I was like, Chris, we could live in that apartment complex over there. And then any time that someone was getting their star in the Walk of Fame, she just kept walking. She was not interested in that lifestyle, apparently. But we saw Daniel Craig, so that was fun. Then we walked to the Hollywood Bowl, arrived just in time to see Garbage, who was the opening act. Cat Power was also an opening act, but we were too slow.
Oh, you're too
but
slow?
We did see Garbage.
Cat Power went on before slow. Garbage.
I guess, yes.
Interesting.
I assume, but we missed.
Yeah.
I don't know Cat Power like at all, but apparently it's got a fan, it's got a following. We saw Garbage. They're fantastic. And Chris reminded me that we had seen them before they opened for U2 on their Elevation tour 20 years ago, which also made us feel super old. And I don't know what it's like. They're a fantastic band, and we've only seen them opening for bigger artists. They're really good. They're also out of Madison, Wisconsin. Fun facts.
Madhouse.
And then, so then Alanis Morissette, the set opens with like a video montage from like 1995 through the present, which included things like, you know, people singing along to these songs, included Jimmy Fallon and Justin Timberlake singing Ironic when they're like they do this little skit where they're like at camp and they're like teenagers, you know, like the little thing like that. And then it was like, and then all these parodies of the Ironic video, which were like, I didn't know there were that many parodies of this video, had a clip of Alanis playing God in the movie Dogma, which I'd forgotten about. It slipped my mind. You know, like, I mean, she was huge. She was so big. She played so God in the late 90s, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and then what I found actually pretty moving was like, they had like clips of basically like YouTube and TikTok of people like covering You Ought to Know, right? And just like went from like one person, two person to like they had like 1,000 like videos on the screen, right? Of like people. And it's like, yeah, what a reflection of like how, what a life your music took on, you know, like what a beautiful thing. So that's how they like started. And then she comes out, right? And she comes out in this like baggy t-shirt that was so 90s. And it was just like at 95 on one sleeve and 25 on the other. And it was like, yep, we're all in on the nostalgia. So it was pretty fantastic. Only criticism was that, like, I mean, it was one of these concerts where, like, for the songs that everybody knew by heart, like, everybody was on their feet and singing along. And then, like, the other, I want to say, like, 70% of the show were songs that, like, most of us did not know.
Yeah.
And we were, like, impressed with, like, her vocal stylings, because she just has this, like, incredible voice. But it was like ballads, and it was by the time that she came on, it was well after 9:30, and we are not young anymore. Like I got the little alert on my phone that was like, it's your bedtime. We're going to put you into sleep mode on your phone. And like Alanis was just coming on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so Chris and I were like, yeah, after 10 o'clock, like we are not ballad people. We can't do that. Like you gotta really bring it after 10 o'clock for us to.
I'm surprised only 30% of the show were the hits.
That's what it felt like. I mean, it was a pretty lengthy set.
If you're on an anniversary tour for an album,
that's what you would think.
I just want you to play the album, I think.
Right.
Right? That's, like,
yeah, that's what you would think. So, the pacing was kind of funny where, like, it was like you'd get, like, just all these slow songs, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh, I guess we're singing You Ought to Know now, right? Like, you'd think that would be, like, a real big buildup, and so I don't know if she's trying to run through some of them or what, but but it was the last night of the tour. She brought her little kids on stage at the end, which was also just this reminder that, like, yep, now we all have kids. It's not 1995 anymore. But what a fun time. I mean, Hollywood Bowl, reveling in 25 years of, wow, memories.
Was Dave Coulier seated near you?
He was not. He was not... not seated there.
Well, yeah. Can't win them all. What a moment for Alanis. I would really like to see because there's a stage show as well, right? Jagged Little Pill.
I've heard that. Stage show
that was getting ready to tour before the pandemic and is not touring right now, that I would love to see.
I bet that would be good because it'd be all killer, no filler, right?
I would assume they're not going to give you the the B-sides of the more recent album.
Right.
I'm assuming that they're recent albums, but gosh, so jealous, man. So jealous.
What have you been up to? You go to concerts too. I had to catch up with you a little bit, just a little bit.
Matt, have we talked about on the podcast the Brandi Carlile experience?
I don't know, but you should talk about it again because she dropped an album.
Yeah, she did. We had Brandi Carlile Day recently. She dropped her new album. It came out. She was touring behind it, and now it's out there, Matt. We had Album Day, and so to celebrate the Album Day, In These Silent Days is the name of the album, which is a really good album. It's a great Brandi album. You should check it out. You should listen to it. It's a good one. I put a little post on the Instagram of a picture of when I saw on September 12th, along with, surprisingly, I think I talked about this, that Hannah and I took our seats at Red Rocks to see Brandi Carlile perform and turned around, and in the row behind me was Savannah Sullivan, friend of the podcast and Lutheran World Federation Youth Program Director.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. I knew I was going to see church people because, like, have you ever been to a Brandi show, Matt?
No.
It's there are tons and tons of lesbians there, and one of the jokes used to be that, like, it was essentially a house for all sinners and saints gathering whenever Brandi would come to town because the whole church would be there. And I've met so many, like, church lesbians at Brandi shows over the years, so I assumed I was going to see people I knew. I did. I saw multiple church people I knew at Red Rocks that night because Brandy was taking us to church. And she was great. Mavis Staples opened. We talked about that. But so I posted a picture of, you know, sunset, twilight at Red Rocks, Brandy playing, and said something along the lines of, you know, happy Brandy Day to everybody. And then, Matt, Brandy Carlisle liked it. She liked my Instagram post, or somebody on her team liked it. So I think we're getting ever closer to, one, hosting a Brandy Carlisle show in my backyard, and two, getting Brandy, who's somewhat Lutheran adjacent, at least, who is known to frequent houses, Lutheran houses of worship in the Pacific Northwest, on the podcast.
Incredible. Incredible stuff. I can't believe it.
Oh, just so exciting. And it is such a good album. I'm going to put a song from it on the playlist. I'll commend to you early on here, Matt, doing things out of order here. Right on Time, is pretty good. I mean, it's really good. As a Dawes person who's had a single called Right on Time not long ago, they gave me permission to like it when they congratulated Brandy on Instagram for the album release. And Brandy, like, screenshotted it and reposted it in her story, or someone on her team did. It's good. It's a good song, too. Also called Right on Time. But, you know, Brandy has done, like, a lot of Joni stuff, and she was really involved in that Joni at 75 thing where a bunch of people covered Joni songs. And there is – she played it at the show, and she was talking about Joni Mitchell, and it was kind of hard to hear. And so I got confused because I thought it was a Joni Mitchell cover, and I was like, I've never heard this Joni Mitchell song before. It's amazing. But it's called You and Me on the Rock. Which is the second track on the album, and it sounds just like a Joni Mitchell song, and it is fantastic. And you should listen to it. It's great. It's a really good one.
That's awesome. I've listened to the album a couple times. It's really good.
It's a good one.
She's had such an interesting career. I mean, she's been around a while. When was her first album? Like 2005 or something? Like
right around there. Because I saw her at Taste of Chicago. In Grant Park.
Oh,
it was 8 trillion degrees, free show, sitting on those metal seats in Grant Park. And afterwards, we went to eat at, what was that, soul food, like Southern soul food restaurant down like in Hyde Park?
Yeah.
Didn't have air conditioning. We made bad choices all over the place. I mean, one of the hottest days of life. But she put on a great show. And I think that was right around, that was 07, I think.
Gotcha.
Like the story came, it was for like the story that.
Right, right. Yep. I remember that album cover. Yeah, like she's been around, and then she had kind of that like mainstream breakthrough with The Joke, right, on the Grammys, and now it feels like she's, I don't know, she has this new level of, I don't know, if people know her or something. Yeah. You know, yeah.
Yeah, for this album, she was on
Ellen. Always been good.
She's,
yeah.
Like, and I didn't know until I was reading the memoir that she's like pretty good friends with Elton John and stuff. Like, and Elton John's really into her, and which makes sense too. Like, and that's one of those connections I hadn't made before. That like when you listen to Brandy and like and put on like a lens of like listen for Elton John, there's a lot of Elton John going on.
So what I hear you saying is we're only two steps removed from Elton John playing a concert in your backyard.
I have an Elton John story. My father-in-law was at an Elton John show way back in the day and had knee surgery or something. So he had a cane and he was in the front row. And Elton pulled him up on stage and danced with him in his cane.
No way. No.
And it was the final number, and Elton John went off stage with his cane and left my father-in-law standing by himself
on
the stage.
No way.
And he had to like hobble around and find somebody to find what happened to his cane.
That's incredible.
But Matt, I'm fired up today, and I want to talk about one important musical issue. There's a podcast that you and I have been slowly listening to. You know, it's appropriate you get to talk about Alanis. You saw Alanis last night. There's a podcast put out by The Ringer on Spotify called 60 Songs That Define the 90s. And last week, Matt, I don't know if you listened to it or not.
No.
Night Swimming by R.E.M.
Oh, I haven't listened to it. Saw it. Haven't listened to it.
It's a beautiful episode, Matt. Okay?
Yeah.
I just want to say that, right? The host, the regular host, is a huge R.E.M. fan. He loves the album, and he can uncritically think about it, right? Which is fantastic. because I'm here for it, right? Like, that's, sign me up.
Right.
An uncritical REM podcast? This sounds fantastic. Listen to it, really well done. And then he brings a guest on, because they normally bring a guest on to talk about the song in the last, like, in kind of like the C section of the podcast. And he intentionally brings on somebody who says, whose public stance on Twitter and stuff, he brings Caspian Kang on.
Oh, no.
Who intentionally, like, their thing is that Night Swimming is the worst song of all time, is his thought, right? And so the dude just rips on REM the entire time. And I can understand how you'd want to, like, balance your, like, completely uncritical take with a critical take. But, like, it was a big bummer, no. Matt. I didn't enjoy it, you know? Like, it's okay for you not to like things. But, like, clearly everybody listening to an hour and a half long podcast about the song Night Swimming is here for it. We don't need to get, like, crapped on for 20 minutes at the end because you're, like, because of your incorrect opinions about R.E.M.
Right? Is he just not like R.E.M. in general, or he just, that particular song rubs him the wrong way?
Oh, no. He hates R.E.M. He didn't need to hear, like, I mean, it was just bad takes. It was just bad takes, Matt. And it's okay for people to have bad takes, but it's not okay for them to do it on a podcast that I'm, like, listening to and feeling all the vibes from. Then he's, like, complaining Michael Stipe's lyrics don't mean anything, and they're just about his, like, introspective feelings, and he never needed to, like, who cares? I don't want to hear about your feelings kind of stuff.
What?
Yeah.
What kind of music does he like?
Who knows? He was growing up in Chapel Hill. And, like, at the time, and, like, had, like, super legit local bands and stuff, right? And so they pretend to come in as, like, a southern, like, college rock band, but they're not at all.
Oh, they were too big.
They're too big, and they're fake, and all they want to do is talk about feelings and cryptic feelings. Like, I don't care that you went swimming one time. Like,
Oh my gosh.
Like, it's super.
It's like a parody of a hot take. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't think there were people that had strong negative feelings about REM. Like, they're pretty respectable.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, you too. There are lots of people that hate you too. I get it.
Yeah.
But REM, like, everybody likes REM, right?
REM through Monster is really hard to, like, deeply hate, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, they didn't even tour this album, right? Like, or Out of Time, they didn't do it. Like, they're, like, they're doing weird, like, I don't know.
All right, so I'll stop the podcast 2/3 of the way in.
Yeah, when the guest comes on, you just have a great day. Like, you know, you've got other things to do, probably.
Amazing. Look at that, 20 minutes of music talk.
20 music minutes. Show's coming together, Matt. I'm really excited. My backyard show.
What's the latest?
Just all systems go, Matt. And you know, Clemson Tide's going to play a show in my backyard. That's what everybody needs to know. And I'm super excited about it and nervous and scared. And what if it snows? That's a possibility.
I was thinking, oh, November in Colorado. Good.
Could be 65, sunny, beautiful. Or could be 10 degrees and a foot of snow. Matt, one important follow-up question before we move on to the text, and that is, what was the merch tent situation with Alanis?
Chris guided me right past it.
What?
Right past it.
Never go to a show with Chris, man.
I glanced over, didn't see anything.
All right.
That I really needed. But the great thing about concerts here, I wonder, like, if it's the same in every venue across the country, but, like, the unofficial market is very high.
There were
people, like, every 6 feet selling t-shirts for $10. Sadly, my guy was not there. There's a guy that works the stadiums near USC.
Yeah.
He usually tosses me a shirt, which is great. But he was not. Didn't see him there this time.
That has not happened to me at Red Rocks. I will tell you that when I got out of the car to go to the Brandy show, which, of course, we're running behind because we're parents and stuff now, and we have to arrange babysitters and all these things. As soon as I get out of the car, this woman, who would be the most stereotypical person you would expect to find roaming the parking lots at Red Rocks, especially for a Brandy Carlile show, who smelled heavily of patchouli, asked if we were interested in buying homemade edibles. I do not poo-poo edibles. Recreational marijuana use in Colorado is legal. It seems, you know, we raise a lot of money for taxes, and it seems like it's good not to have the black market. But, Matt, one thing I'm never, ever going to buy are homemade edibles from a stranger. Like,
never,
ever in my life will I do that, Matt. Like, that's like the dumbest, like the worst choice you could make in life. Starts like a story of something really bad that happened to you begins with that. That's where it starts. Edibles, notorious, incredible. Matt. Notorious for like for being difficult to ascertain the strength of an edible, and you want to go with this person who smells of patchouli walking the parking lot.
Homemade though, locally.
Locally sourced.
Locally made. Mm-hmm. Locally sourced. There you go. There you go. Yeah, no, that finding a babysitter, I mean, that's real. It's a real. That was going to be my biggest obstacle.
Yeah.
To go to this concert. Fortunately, this is my last story. I did find someone, the council president at my congregation, was willing to step in. And she said, "Oh, who are you going to go see?" And I said, "Alanis Morissette." And she goes, Oh, does she do In the Arms of an Angel? And I was like, no, that's Sarah McLachlan. It's another white lady from the 90s. She does like You Ought to Know, and she gave me a blank look. And it's just cross-cultural sharing, Zach. That's just, you know, we didn't all have the exact same experience.
It's important for us to exchange, all of us to exchange and receive the things that are important to us and our cultures.
So... yeah, Sarah McLachlan, Alanis Morissette, two different people.
Notably, Alanis Morissette hates dogs.
Notably. Well, now that we have covered music.
Speaking of people getting really upset.
Yeah. Oh, this is it. This is the best part of Job right here. Job 38, 1 to 7, and then 34 to 41. I guess this goes on for a while, but we're going to cut out. See, unlike Alanis Morissette, they're just going to cut out the filler.
That's right.
Just give you the hits. So here we go. The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Yep, I use that line a lot. It's one of my favorite lines. Gird up your loins like a man. One that you have
look
used.
Look out. Be careful.
I will question you, and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if we have understanding. Who determined its measurement? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? What were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy? And then we fast forward. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds so that a flood of waters may cover you? Can you send forth lightnings so that they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the inward parts or given understanding to the mind? Who has the wisdom to number the clouds? Or who can get, what an image, tilt the water skins of the heavens when the dust runs into a mass and the clods cling together? Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions or while they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in their covert? Who provides for the raven its prey when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food? Word of God.
Word of life, man.
Word of the whirlwind.
Oh. That's the
incredible stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so good. I wish we read it more. Like, it's so good. God really brings it. I mean, you know, there's the big picture of what God is doing here. Just putting Job and his friends, mostly his friends, in their place. But the poetry and imagery in here, God doesn't skimp on the songwriting. Mm-hmm. Like, you would think the guitars of Coming Out of a Whirlwind would be enough, right? Just swirling mm-hmm. guitar, like, it'd be enough. You could just, but he doesn't skimp on the lyrics, Zach. He doesn't skimp on the lyrics.
Oh, amazing. You're right. He fills it out, man. I mean, we do cut. he gets to be a little Dylan-esque, I guess, with his verses after verses after verses.
I suppose.
We do cut eight.
I mean, my only question, it's true. It is a bit long. My only question is, he's speaking out of the whirlwind, and these are a lot of complicated lines. In my experience with outdoor worship, one of the challenges is getting crystal clear sound.
Yeah.
When you are using, you know, when you have a whirlwind of Vermont Avenue next to your courtyard. So I just don't know how God spoke all these words quite so clearly in the midst of a whirlwind. I just wonder what the sound system was like. That's my main question here.
Clearly better than what we're working with, Matt. Hopefully you had a windscreen on the microphone that day.
That's right.
I like this reading, Matt, but I'm not sure I love it in Job. You know, I like the idea. You know, I mean, this is a lot of what I end up telling young adults and students, right? Like, I do wonder, right? Like, there's this interesting relationship between the questions that people are asking, that young adults ask, right? That they're deeply interested in. And one of those questions is, what should I do with my life? And that's a great question, and students care a lot about it. And I think in part, the church hasn't always done a great job because we've gotten so excited that students, that young adults have shown up with a question that they care about, that we do everything to bend over backwards to help them come up with answers for that question because that's what they want. But I just continue to find that the answers to those questions don't matter very much, that it's not like the idea that a student, 18 to 22-year-old, is going to come up with a really clear picture of what the rest of their life should look like. Whatever that picture is not going to be helpful at best. You know, and I worry more for students who come up with really clear answers. I mean, my personal experience as a undergrad in civil engineering, there's a part of me that's like, that would have been really a bummer if I just graduated at 22 and then I did engineering for the next 45, 50 years because that's what I decided to do when I was 20. And so, like, clarity isn't, it's a thing we want, but then a thing that's not very life-giving. So I like the word. I mean, that God appears to speak out of like a whirlwind, which is a thing I think of as a thing that is like obfuscated, not clear in of itself, is an important thing. And I think, you know, can be turned into good news that God's very being here is not clear. So the fact that you haven't achieved clarity in life about what it is you're supposed to be doing is not a failure of you or a failure of God.
So you started by saying you didn't like this in Job. Is that because you find it an unhelpful response to
God seems really wise here. And I have struggled reconciling the God that I hear speaking these words with the God from chapter 1, who seems bored
and
not nice, like, or not particularly concerned with the fate of individual humans. Like, that's the part that I'm like, well, this doesn't seem like the same character.
Yeah.
We are 38 chapters later, so.
I mean, it's an interesting, like, if you take it out of a pious lens and you're like, and you take Job as like, here's a picture of the world as like the capriciousness of the world, right? Like sometimes the world that we live in is so absurd that it's like chapter 1. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's so like overwhelming that it's like chapter 38 and we're just like, God, just the overwhelming beauty of this, like this is just beyond me. Look at this universe. Like it's terrifying and beautiful all in the same breath. And then other times it's just completely absurd, like chapter 1. And I don't know that either one of those is like the way we usually think about the way that we've been trained to think about God or the way we've been trained to think about like, but it does feel like honest.
Yeah. And maybe that's a part of reading Job that's helpful too, is to read it a bit like we talked about, you know, reading it as absurd, that maybe chapter 1's not like intended to be an accurate description of what God did one time, But like, if you want a clear picture of God, if clarity is what's important, look, here's a really clear picture of God, and I don't think that's what we want or find truth in.
Yeah. Because, like, I mean, I guess I, like, one way it's helpful is that, like, we have this ingrained message in our culture. Like, this ties into the vocational piece where it's like, you figure out exactly what you want to do, and then you work really hard at it, and that's how you, and then everything works out for you because you have done all the right things. And that's what, like, a meaningful life is. Mm-hmm. And Job, like, just puts a grenade in that and blows it up and says that's not, like, yeah, that might work for, like, a couple years, and then something's going to happen, and the bottom drops out, right?
Yeah.
And so it really, I guess it puts the lie to, like, the myths that we try to tell ourselves. And if you can clear away those myths, then maybe it does open up a new kind of freedom for how you might live within it. Maybe Job by itself is not enough of a roadmap to a meaningful life, but maybe it is a tool for, like, clearing away a lot of the unhelpful, like, things that we tell ourselves.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you said meaningful life. I mean, that's the critique I'm following.
Yeah, you're going to come at me for that.
Yeah, that's right. The critique I'm sharpening at the church and myself, right, and the work that I've done is I think we've been so eager to have good answers to the question of, like, what should my life look like? That really what we've ended up doing, we thought we were in this business of taking a model that said the point of life is to, like, make a bunch of money. And really we've just taken that system and substituted meaning for money. So that now the point of life, we haven't changed the system at all. We've just changed the currency so that the point of life is to have the most meaningful life you could possibly have. Which I don't think is quite right and faithful either.
What do you think is there a correct answer?
No. Mm-hmm. I think the answer looks like the whirlwind here, right? That you're going to get, the whirlwind's not just descriptive of God, but it's descriptive of a life, I think, in God. You walk into the whirlwind and you get turned around and nothing goes in the way you expect it to, and that you're called, I think, just to do the things that need to be done in the place in which you find yourself.
How do you know what needs to be done?
You know, in Luther's terms, Luther talks about it in terms of changing diapers.
Right, but if I've got 100 diapers to change, how do I choose which one?
You do choose the ones in your hand.
What if they're all in my hand?
You got big hands.
I mean, I think at some point, like, you have to make choices. Like, sure. It isn't just like, well, this thing is, like, I could choose to stay at work, or I could choose to go home and, like, care for my family. Like, at a certain point, I have to make this choice. Both things need to be done, but I get to decide which of those things that I'm going to do.
Yeah. I don't think it matters. Yeah, I just don't think the choice matters that much.
You don't think the choice matters that much?
Between the things, if you're choosing among things that need to be done.
Well, if it's like the trolley problem and you can save, like, how do you, like, the choice matters. It's going to matter to the person that's waiting at home for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think where I would push it is that, like, at a certain point, your values are going to come into play, and you're going to have to weigh the different choices before you. And meaning might come into play when you start to weigh, like, what your choices are. Like, at a certain point, like, Luther made a choice. Like, he could have just kept doing what the church told him to do, but instead he, like, made these choices to do other things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think your ethics, you know, help you decide what needs to be done.
Yeah.
But that we've glamorized a particular, right? Like, it, your life means more if you can go work for an NGO in Panama. Than it does if you change diapers.
Right.
Or care for,
right,
you know.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah, so, like, Agreed. So Job, I feel like Job still sweeps aside, right? Like all those myths, including that one, right? That there isn't like this perfect formula that you can like snap into. But you're going to muddle through and like make these choices along the way. And sometimes it's going to go well. And sometimes it's not going to go well. But
yeah, I mean, I'm coming off of met up with a young alum last night. Who's got like lots of like every part of their life. It's just great, right? Like, except the career part, right? The career part's not like they haven't found that their Parker Palmer career or whatever.
Right.
And so what am I supposed to say like in that to somebody? You know, like I don't think those of us who work with young adults are practiced at like saying like, yeah, sometimes you just have a job, like, but like the work and all these other parts of your vocation are as important as career. Because that's not the story that we like, that's not the story on a college campus that people want to hear, is that you may just get a job at the end of this and like other parts of your life could be really meaningful.
Yeah. No, that's totally. Yeah. Where does that leave us?
Well, it leaves us here in the 10th chapter of Mark.
Oh, good. This looks relevant, actually.
We might have found a connection here. I didn't have, you can see in the notes, Matt, that our listeners cannot. I didn't have much to say. I did the Greek work and did nothing. Nothing just came, nothing happened. James and John. The sons of thunder of Zebedee came forward to Jesus and asked him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." Mark, and this shriek of disciples, like just really unstellar behavior repeatedly, denying children, asking who gets to be the greatest, and here, "We just want you to do whatever we want." Hey, Jesus asked, "What is it that you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Well, simply grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" And they replied, "Oh, yeah, no problem. We are able." Just an editor's note here. If you are in the Bible and say, "We are able," good things don't happen for able, right? In the Bible. Did that joke work?
Yeah.
Then Jesus said to him, "The cup that I drink, you will drink." "And the cup, the baptism with which I'm baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right or my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." And when the other disciples, the 10, heard this, they began to be angry with James and John. So Jesus called them together and said, "You know that among the Gentiles, those whom they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. But it is not so among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." The good news of Jesus Christ.
Praise to you, O Christ. Here we are. What's the connection? What do we got?
I see it here that we have James and John aspiring to a vocation of greatness. You know, they want to figure out how their lives can be. If I want to read this in somewhat of a sympathetic manner, right? That they're aspiring to figure out how their lives can be most meaningful and impactful and important, which is a thing that many of us perhaps is not as distant or audacious and ridiculous sounding as like, "We want you to do whatever we tell you to do, Jesus." But they want this thing for themselves. It doesn't work out for them. There's a pattern that's emerging here, Matt, and I'm thinking of this in real time as we're recording, which is right before March the 10th. So I'm thinking about sermon writing at the moment for last week. where the rich man comes, right? Mm. And there's a connection there. We talked about it with Lamont. There's a connection in, it says the rich man comes and kneels down before Jesus to ask him the question. So what I'm going to do in this sermon that you heard earlier today, friends, at Rejoice Lutheran Church in Erie, Colorado, is that word only gets used twice in the Gospel of Mark. And the first time is in chapter 1 when a leper kneels before Jesus and asks that he be made clean. And so I'm doing some compare and contrast there. And the compare part, the parts that are similar, is that Jesus responds with love and compassion each time to both of them, right? He loved the rich man, and you get the good word in chapter 1 where he, like, is moved with compassion in his innards. But I think the thing that's different, if we're to line all of these up, another group of people coming to Jesus and asking him for something, what the leper asks for is wholeness and to be made whole. What the rich man's asking for and what James or John are asking for are aspiring for things outside of themselves, things that they are not in any sense owed. And again, to put it in that limited goods worldview, like honor, there's only so much honor to go around. And when you're aspiring to stuff that doesn't belong to you, you're taking it off of someone else's plate. So that's kind of how I'm seeing the text today, at least.
Yeah, it is, like, it is really striking what they're asking for. Grant us to sit one at your right and one at your left in your glory. It's this question of what you want, and Jesus says, you don't know what you're asking. I mean, to, like, that you set some goal for yourself, you pursue that goal, this is the career I'm going to have, and then you get there, and you sit in that seat, and you go, oh, this is not what I expected, this is not... Actually, this doesn't fulfill every pore of my being.
Right?
And Jesus tells them even worse. It's actually, like, it's going to be execution. But what a poignant thing, right? Like, because what do we feel that way? There is something in us that, like, wants to, like, so what do we put in that place? What is it? What do we want? Like, how do you answer that question? So it's poignant to see them asking the wrong questions here, or to be pursuing the wrong thing, I guess, to fill that thing inside of them with the wrong thing. And Jesus tries to warn them, but yeah.
I mean, you can really see here as well, like, Jesus also in some ways modeling, I think, what the power dynamics of it all, because he does have a ton of power among the disciples. And he has the ability to play them against each other and to, you know, if there are things that they could do to achieve for him, right? Like, he has the ability to do that, to get them to do those things. And he refuses to take the kinds of power that we think of as just good politics, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And as we sit here recording, hoping that there's a government next week and stuff.
Yeah.
That you get here not only, like, an answer that's realistic, but I think the behavior that demonstrates that, like...
Right.
And not claiming greatness.
Well, I guess the other thing that strikes me is that, like, is less Jesus's answer as, like, the answer or, like, the solution, or as opposed to, like, the disciples are get it wrong and Jesus is going to, like, correct them. And then they're going to try again. And they're just like, they're just going to continue this pattern. But that's actually, like, what life's pattern is, right? Yeah. Like, it's not like you just choose serving it. No, like, you, like, pursue. And then, like, hopefully you talk to your, like, you like, work it out, right? You got to continually correct and self-correct. And, I don't know. That rings true to me, right? Like, rather than, like, your job is to figure out what you're going to do for the next 30 years of your life, as opposed to, like, what kinds of patterns are you going to live into, and are you going to be open to, like, I mean, you can't even know, right? But at least to, like, prepare ourselves for, like, oh, actually, this is what it looks like. Like, it's a continual relearning. And in 5 years and 20 years and 3 months, you might relearn again. You might rethink it. And that's okay. That's actually what life is going to look like.
Mm-hmm. There's a... One of the things that's happening here, too, because we're at the very end, like, Jesus is about to enter Jerusalem. We're about to get a horse and pony and ride on in here. One of the things that's getting worked out here is there's that I think the disciples are pretty important in Mark. And there's some clarity in the calling of the disciples that they're making this big, like, countercultural movement away from their family systems and breaking those ties and going with Jesus. And Jesus is the new person who, like, around whom their lives orbit, operate, right? But the thing, it seems here, that's happening is that it's the relationship between each individual disciple and Jesus that seems to be operative. James and John approach together because they have an existing family tie. And so they're trying to get closer to Jesus than everyone else. Whereas I think what Jesus hopes for us and for this community and for this group of disciples is that what holds them together is not their, like, individual relationship with Jesus, but their relationships with one another, that we're creating a new family system where the ties are going all directions and not just from, in the Roba Molina terms, from, like, the patron and the servant. And they've missed that pretty significantly here.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
That old, like, the old family system's got its, like, fingers in here. James and John still brothers, because if one of them went by themselves, like, that would be an affront to the old family system, and we haven't let go of that yet.
Well, they're even still named here at the beginning as the sons of Zebedee. Like, it's a little...
Just one group. One thing. One person.
Mm-hmm. Sons of Thunder.
I mean, maybe that's why they left it in there. It's just a kick-ass band name.
It is. It's a kick-ass band name. And, I mean, look at this Sunday. This is a Thunder Sunday. You get the Whirlwind and the Sons of Thunder.
Oh, dang, it's in my song, Matt. I didn't even make the connection. This segues us perfectly into the playlist.
Incredible. Well, let's talk about the playlist.
Well, Matt, you know, I'm going to start with that one then, since it's there. Listening to that beautiful podcast episode until the end on Night Swimming and Automatic for the People, it had me land upon another killer, a little deeper cut called Sweetness Follows off of Automatic for the People.
Yeah.
And it has a beautiful, the whole album is beautiful, all right? If you want to take your shots at Man on the Moon, I'm fine with that, right? Like, it is a little, like, it didn't...
Sidewinder Sleeps Tonight? No.
I like Sidewinder Sleeps Tonight. I don't care. Great. I think that's actually a pretty good song. You can take your Everybody Hurts shots, do it, right? Rest of the album, I think, holds up incredibly well. That's it. Because you can't understand, like, how popular, like, Out of Time was such an unexpected and massive cultural success. But Sweetness Follows, beautiful song. And here you go. It's you giving your vocational advice here, Matt. It's these little things they can pull you under. Live your life filled with joy and wonder. I always knew this altogether thunder was lost in our little lives. Oh, Sweetness Follows, Matt. Sweetness Follows. Oh, such a good song.
It is. It's really
Matt,
good.
With the cellos. So I'm putting that on there. We got Thunder. We got the Sons of Thunder. Live your life filled with joy and wonder. There's brokenness here, but Sweetness Follows. Then, Matt, as I'm listening to more and more Clemson, I'm going a little further back into his catalog, into the band's catalog from back in the day, off of their 2005 album, Jews for Jesus Blues, which is a killer song. Have you heard this before, man?
No.
It's so good. You got to listen to it. Here's your verse. There's only verses. I don't want to suffer and I don't want to die. I want the clouds parted in an endless blue sky. But someone up there has a different plan. Now that I'm saved, I wish I was damned. Oh, wanting all that clarity, but then missing the other, like, verses end, you know, now that I'm lost, I wish I was, or now that I'm found, I wish I was lost, or I miss being lost. There you go. And finally, Matt, I mean, that's your joke special there. And then deeper cut off of the Brandy album, Sinners, Saints, and Fools. Check it out. It's a ballad about a guy who's really into rules and getting in and out of places and gates and walls and stuff. But he finds himself, in the end, on the wrong side of the pearly gates, man.
Good stuff. Good stuff.
Boom. What are you playing? What is your on your soundtrack for a world?
What? Yeah, what shall I play? Well, I'm going to do the same song I did 3 years ago, because once I see it, I can't unsee it. That got out of the whirlwind.
That's why I never took basically, my
notes. Basically, Moana in Moana is singing You're
Moana
Welcome.
Moana 3 years old now? Jeez.
I know. It's insane. Dwayne Johnson, Lin-Manuel Miranda, the songwriter. You're Welcome. I mean, it basically is got out of the whirlwind. It's just what a connection. And then I felt like I had to do an Alana song, and it made me think. This was my other reminder from the cut. I'd forgotten this, Zach, but this kicks off Jagged Little Pill, All I Really Want, and it starts with a harmonica, and she came out with the harmonica, and anytime she pulled out the harmonica, crowd went nuts. So the harmonica, quite the crowd pleaser at the Alana show, and I forgot what a role the harmonica plays in this.
In the
really
90s.
Just what an album,
Blues Traveler.
And if you're trying to picture God's voice in Job, I know you want this thunderous boom, but, you know, Alanis once played God in Dogma, the Kevin Smith movie, where she opened her mouth, let her voice out, and exploded Ben Affleck's head. I don't know if y'all remember this movie. It was a thing. It was a thing at the time. And then finally, something that could have happened only in a fever dream of myself. John Mellencamp and Bruce Springsteen singing together for the first time on a song, Wasted Days, which is a song about mortality. Fun fact about John Mellencamp, he's been singing about mortality since the 80s when he was a much younger man, but he just keeps singing the same song about how life just keeps passing you by and it just, you know, soon it'll be over. So on that note,
Matt, what an up. I'd just like to say, Matt, that as you and I, both lifelong Dodgers fans, still looking forward to the baseball playoffs. This is a Dodgers podcast now.
Well, you know, I was born in San Francisco, so I don't know.
Oh, it's going to be a tough one for you, Matt. Got to be a tough series for you. Let's just keep it alive in the parking lots.
Maybe that's either the Dodgers or the Giants calling me right now. I think I'm getting called up from the minor leagues. So it's been real.
Real vinyl.